Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 20, for February 3rd, 2009. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm very happy to have you with me, as always. I'm flying solo today. No Gamers Confab section of the podcast today, partly because I kind of did a blowout last time over the holidays, but also because I've heard from a few people saying, you know, you should keep doing your own segments, and that makes sense to me. So it's just me today, sort of old school Brainy Gamer podcast. But next time I'll be back with another edition of the Gamers Confab. I really love doing those, and lots of you have told me that you enjoy them, so I'll be back to that next time. I don't know about you, but man, I'm sitting here in my office recording this podcast today as 4 more inches of snow are hitting the ground. It's really beautiful. I mean, it's just gorgeous out, if you like snow, but if you don't, it's really becoming increasingly miserable around here. We had a foot of snow a couple weeks ago, and none of it's really melted. It just keeps blowing around, and I know some places are better than others at moving snow around and making sure people can get where they need to go. I live in Indiana, and it's, you know, it's not too bad. We sort of know how to plow snow here, but I'm just starting to get that feeling of, you know, get me out of here. I'm just starting to feel really itchy for spring. And I know that part of it is because I'm a baseball fan, and pitchers and catchers are reporting to spring training very soon. Every year I can't help thinking about spring when that happens. So I know I talk about baseball and I write about it sometimes on my blog, and you know, not a lot of my readers are baseball fans, I think, but I'm thinking about baseball, which means I'm thinking about spring, which means I'm really tired of snow. But, you know, I suppose one upside is that it kind of forces you to stay inside, and when you're inside, you play more games. And a little curtailed on the activity lately because I'm in rehearsal for a production. A lot of you know that I'm a theater professor, and I teach drama and acting and that sort of thing. And each year I direct one production here in our theater with our theater majors and minors. And I'm in that right now. So what it really means is that I get significantly less time to play games, which is, you know, it's actually kind of a nice palate cleanser for me. Gives me a little bit of a break, and I get to sort of clear my head. And the timing's pretty good because there aren't a lot of really high-profile games coming out right now. But I have to admit, you know, I'm getting a little itchy to get back into some more sustained gaming time. And when I am able to play, it's really squeezed in between things. And I've been getting up in the morning earlier and earlier just to be able to play games, which is really bizarre if you think about it. You know, kind of rolling out of bed before you have to go to work so you can get some gaming in. But other than playing really late at night, which the older I get, the harder that is for me, it's, you know, it's my chance to play some games. So it's not so bad. Well, I have 3 segments for you today. In my first segment, I'm going to talk about something that really concerns me, and it has to do with downloadable content and how downloadable content in narrative games communicates a certain set of values about what game designers really think about narrative and storytelling and characters. And I'm making this, I guess, somewhat exaggerated claim that downloadable content, particularly as it's coming to us in the new Prince of Persia game, is a real kind of act of betrayal in a certain way from the developers to the players. And I'll try to explain what I mean by that. In the second segment, I want to talk about peace and love and tolerance. And I want to talk about them in context with a game that I've been playing recently with the Vintage Game Club, Beyond Good and Evil. And it's become apparent to me in this playthrough of the game, and I've played it before, I've written about it before, that there are certain kinds of values that this game communicates that put it in kind of rarefied air, I think, when it comes to video game narrative and characters and the ways in which the game puts you in the position of kind of navigating through a world that does in all sorts of interesting ways communicate these values to us. And It's up to other things too. I think there are some reflections on some rather contemporary issues that we face today, sort of post-Iraq war issues that may or may not have been intentionally incorporated into the game, but I think resonate in some very interesting ways. And in the third segment, I'm going to talk a little bit about spoilers. I wrote about it on my blog and received a pretty significant amount of feedback on it. And I think I learned some things from that conversation that I'd like to kind of expand on here. And I also want to clarify a few ideas that I tried to communicate in the blog post, but may not have done a very good job of, and sort of incorporate some of the ideas that emerged in the conversation that I think are useful. My thesis, as you may know if you've read the piece, is that I think we're sort of needlessly obsessed with spoilers, and that they've come to sort of frame our discourse when we talk about games in ways that I think aren't very helpful, particularly as we think about game criticism. Now, I mean, having said that, clearly a lot of people feel very strongly that we shouldn't give away information about games just willy-nilly, just to sort of be cute or nasty or whatever. And that's understandable. People want to be surprised when a certain plot point occurs or a certain character tidbit is revealed in a game. So I get that, and I'm not suggesting we need to be callous about just ignoring people's concern about spoilers. But the whole question of spoilers, I think, calls into question kind of how we think about games and what experience we expect from them and how games, communicate meaning to us. So just a few thoughts about that in the final segment of the podcast, and I hope you'll find it interesting. So there you have it, and away we go. When the new Prince of Persia game came out, I didn't really have any particular plans for spending much time with it, frankly. I was very interested in the art style of the game. I'm kind of a sucker for games that go against the photorealism default kind of graphic style, and clearly they were going for something different, rather more painterly, and so I appreciated that, and I really wanted to take a look at it. I played the game with family and friends over the holidays, and they loved it because it's very easy to get into, and most of them are very casual gamers, so it's a very accessible game, and I grew to like the kind of in-the-zone gameplay that it offers. You string together moves, and the game's very friendly. It sort of helps you in ways that I know some gamers don't like, but I wasn't looking for a challenging game, and it didn't seem to me that it aspired to be a really tough platformer. So I didn't really expect that, and I found it, just in terms of gameplay, a lot of fun to get in that kind of zone where you just make your way through and collect the orbs and enjoy, the environments, which are really cool. So I initially approached the game as that kind of an experience without much thought to narrative. But as the game started to draw me in, particularly the character of Elika, the princess, it began to make me think more about the story they were trying to tell. And despite my not expecting to, I started to get interested in it. And so I followed it along, and I'd written on the blog about, some pretty big issues I have with the narrative, and particularly with the prince himself, to me, a fairly despicable character, frankly. But that's me, and I know other people feel differently. But, all in all, I did find myself growing more interested in the narrative and more interested in the kind of repartee that was developing between the prince and Elika over the course of the game. It wasn't until the end of the game that the experience of Prince of Persia really sort of reached out and grabbed me, because now I'm going to reveal some spoilers. So here we go with the spoilers thing. I'll talk about that later in the podcast, but I am going to reveal some spoilers here. So heads up. At the end of the game, you're faced with this situation where you have to decide whether or not to revive Elika. Now, I've written about this on my blog, and I know a lot of people see this very differently, but my take on that was that the game leaves that as an open-ended choice. You can decide to revive her or not, and if you decide not to, the game's over for you, basically. But, clearly the game tips towards, it sort of leans toward the idea of reviving her, even though the credits have rolled before that. It's kind of a fake ending, and I think they're trying to be very clever with it. You rescue her, and she comes back to life, and you know, ultimately my perspective on that was that you've betrayed her, because the very thing that she intended to do, that she gave her life for, to sort of make this Ahriman character disappear forever, you've now brought him back out of purely selfish motives. And now she's back in the world and she has to continue battling this guy. And I think that's terrible. But that's the ending the game sort of pushes you toward, despite my feeling that you don't have to accept that ending. You can you know, walk away from it. But all of that, you know, be that as it may, the game has, in my opinion, a really interesting and provocative kind of end sequence. And regardless of whether you feel connected to the prince, as I said, I didn't, or Elika, which I did very much feel connected to her, the story goes a certain way. And, you know, there are all kinds of other implications with story, in the sense that you have all these powers and you have to earn them a certain way, and there are these lands that you discover, and it's a very, very self-contained thing. Now, granted, at the end of the game, it seems very clear that the game wants to suggest that there's going to be a sequel, because now they're both still alive and there's still more fighting that needs to be done and the world has to be rescued again. So, you know, the door is open for sequel. So I get that. But the issue that I have with the announcement of what Ubisoft is calling the new Prince of Persia epilogue, and it's described as 3 hours of additional gameplay, the problem I have with this is that it's essentially a kind of a confirmation of the thing that I always tell my friends and colleagues isn't true about games, which is narrative and character don't really matter. It's really all just about running around and shooting things or killing things or jumping on things or doing whatever games ask you to do. And they sort of tack these stories on as kind of a way of adding a structure to them. I've argued against that, and I've tried over the years to sort of counter those arguments with examples of how games can truly create engaging narrative and characters. And even in Prince of Persia, a sort of highly flawed narrative game, I think, there's still, in my view, a very kind of self-contained world that's created, that things are explained, that you live inside that world under the rules that are established by its designers. Until the designers want more money. And then they change it. And to me, it feels a bit like a betrayal. Now, I can imagine that some people would think, oh, you're just overreacting and you should never take it so seriously to begin with, and it's just a game and blah, blah, blah. And that's really the thing for me. That's where it really starts to get to me. This we're back to that crazy defense, it's just a game. Right? If you invest yourself into the narrative and the characters and you understand them within the world of the game as it's presented to you, you invest yourself in that in a way that I would argue is pretty significant. And I mean, I don't think I'm wrong to assume that the game wants that, right? That the designers intend for the player to have that kind of engagement. And you hear the designers talk about it when they're promoting the game. This is going to be a really engaging game, and you're going to really care about the prince. You're going to really care about their backstories, and we're going to make Elika a very rich character. You can find these quotes, pre-kind of release quotes from the designers of the game. So I'm taking them at their word that they're offering us that kind of engagement. But when we do it, when we invest in it, and when we sort of fill in the gaps that the narrative maybe inadvertently or unintentionally creates, we sort of imaginatively fill those in, or we overlook them or whatever, somehow we meet the game halfway and we make this into a story, particularly with the character of Elika, that has resonance. When the designers, when the developer, the publisher, whoever comes to us and says, hey, you know what? Actually, if you give us some more money, we'll give you more game. And what it does, ultimately, in my view, is sort of defeat the notion that this game exists as a kind of self-contained narrative. Now, I understand the idea that if you leave the ending open, then you've said, well, you know, we've already told you there's going to be more game to come, so we're just giving it to you. But that's not really what's happening, folks. I mean, if you look at the way that they're promoting the epilogue, what they're offering isn't a bunch of story that will help us you know, understand the characters or put some sort of an interesting button or twist on this. I mean, that's not the deal. The deal is they want to give you more stuff. They want to give you more moves. They want to give you a new area to explore. They want to give you more gameplay. And they want to respond to players who complain that the game was too easy. So if you look at the way that Ubisoft has been promoting this epilogue, here's what they're saying. They're giving you a new sprinting clash ability, which adds this extra move to the prince's repertoire of combat tricks, right? And that's as they've described it in response to some players who felt the combat was too easy or too one-dimensional. You get unlockable skins for the prince and for Elika, so you can see how the characters look during the early prototype phase of the game's development. You get this new power pack that gives an extra power to Elika. It gives you a brand new location in the game, and it gives you what Ubisoft is describing as more intensity. That's their word, not mine. That what they're up to is trying to alter the way the game plays and feels and make it more feel more dangerous, make it feel more difficult. All this stuff, ability to stun the attacker, the ability to turn that into taking the offensive as a move that the prince can do. All of this is, in the words of Ubisoft, looking at an interview on IGN, an intent to make even more intense combat sequences and memorable moments in duels. And then, as kind of an afterthought, in the same interview, the PR person says, quote, "And we will develop the relationship between the prince and Elika following the end of the game." And I'm thinking, actually, no, you won't. No, you will not develop their relationship. They'll get some extra dialogue. They'll toy with each other with some more repartee. Maybe, you know, somebody will mention something that will lead us to think there's going to be more information later in a sequel. But they're not making the epilogue to create a new dynamic kind of narrative turn that will continue to compel us to be interested in these characters. That's not what this is about. It's about adding more gameplay and charging you for that and giving you some cool moves and putting a new dungeon in there and making the people who wanted the game harder happy. Now, I'm aware that I'm very sort of grousing and grouchy about this in ways that probably may seem to some people as just sort of silly, that, you know, get over it. They're adding more content to a game. I get to play more Prince of Persia. I love the game, so what's wrong with that? It just, to me, is a kind of a confirmation of the thing that we don't want to be true often, but I think which is ultimately very true about many mainstream AAA big narrative games, and that is narrative really ultimately is just a kind of a tacked on thing. And if we want to make it more than that, we're free to do it. We're free to use our imaginations. We're free to fill in gaps. We're free to, you know, whatever, engage however we want. We can use Lee Alexander's term, engagement is a choice, right? But I think the signal that we receive if we sort of look at it through coldly objective eyes is this is a game about platforming and combat. And this epilogue, which even just the term epilogue, which suggests a kind of literary addition, something that has more narrative content, something more to say. It's not really an epilogue. It's more stuff to do. And that's fine. That's fine if, for players who are looking for more to do in Prince of Persia. But from where I sit, it really feels like a kind of an act of betrayal. I've been enjoying revisiting one of my favorite games, Beyond Good and Evil, over at the Vintage Game Club, and we'd love to have you over there if you're interested in jumping in. It's certainly not too late. We take it very slowly, actually, probably more slowly than many gamers are accustomed to going, mainly just to allow ourselves to be able to share comments and give people an opportunity to reflect on the game a little bit and share ideas before kind of plowing through it as we often do. And I, you know, promise not to get on my soapbox about chewing your food anymore, but I do think it can be nice to slow down occasionally. And if you are interested in joining us, you don't have to play slowly. We lay out threads that break the game down into sections. So, you know, if you want to storm ahead, you can just get advanced to a thread and begin posting there, and no one will see your comments until they're ready to see them. So in that way, you can kind of proceed at your own pace, and people can post wherever they happen to be in the game in the appropriate thread. You know, I'm struck by the game this time in ways that I think I have been in the past, but without really stopping to note it or to carefully pay attention to it. And, you know, it's not a perfect game. It's got flaws, and I'll talk more about some of those, particularly regarding how the mechanics of the game don't necessarily always reinforce the narrative, which is kind of an old song for those of us who talk about games these days. But there are things that it does really just so extraordinarily well. And I think the thing it does best, more than any other element of the game, it communicates values to the player that embrace virtues that games rarely contemplate, and that would be things like peacefulness and acceptance of everyone, a certain kind of embrace of tolerance. It conveys a nurturing sense, particularly through the character of Jade, the protagonist of the game, that she is this very, very nurturing soul. She runs this orphanage. She has this Uncle Paige. And the ways in which those nurturing qualities are depicted, it's not communicated simply by little snippets of dialogue or little, you know, character interactions when you click on them. It's animated. It's part of the physical sort of realization of the character in the game. I can't think of another game that, you know, includes the kinds of animations that we see between Jade and her Uncle Paige, that she's, you know, genuinely affectionate with him, and the way she touches him, the way she embraces him, the way that they talk to each other in these kind of joking, very familiar ways, but very loving ways. As a sidekick character, I think Jade is very useful because he helps kind of flesh out Jade's character and helps us see the side of her that I think the game is most interested in, which is this photographer who is, you know, very bold, she's intrepid, she's courageous, she's all these really great things. She's also a heck of a fighter. But it's interesting to me that the game is significantly less interested in her fighting than it is in, I would argue, than in her skills as a photographer, for example. It's interesting to me that the photography in the game, which you could see as a certain kind of just basic collection mechanic, right? It's just a thing that you do in the game to earn pearls. But I think the game is pretty careful about making it more interesting than that, because the photography is actually very hard to do well. And particularly if you want to get the creatures that are coming at you, the big boss sort of creatures, you need to be pretty quick about getting that photograph or you're going to get hit before you have a chance to take it. And so in that way, I think the game communicates that the photography and her effort to try to catalog the species in the world in which she's living, which is very socially conscious, environmentally conscious sort of activity, she is engaged in this from the player's point of view in mechanical but also in narrative ways, much more interesting, the photography, than just, you know, battling creatures, which I suppose you could say that the combat in the game is one of its weakest elements, that the designers actually don't seem terribly interested in making the combat unique or compelling in any way. It's, you know, basically button mashing and off you go. Their interest seems to be more in things that resonate with Jade's character and which help us understand who she is. And also working cooperatively with Paige or with other characters in the game. A lot of the times what's interesting about the dungeons isn't so much the combat or how you defeat things, but it's more how you navigate through it cooperatively with your partner, working together in ways that I think, even some of the Zelda games, which this game is clearly imitative of, Zelda games have been much less creative, I think, in cooperative relationships between two characters who must work together in order to solve problems. I think the Zelda games are, it's more typical that it's going to be some tool or some weapon or some thing you discover which gets you out of a dungeon. It's kind of the Zelda 101 design philosophy. You discover the boomerang, and so the next dungeon requires you to use that boomerang a lot. In this game, I think it tends to be more reflective of the storytelling. The things that happen to you, the things you discover in the game, reflect back on the storytelling. And related to this, I think there's the questions of race and ethnicity that arise in this game, which are, I think, worth exploring. I'm not the first person to suggest that no one's quite sure what race or ethnicity Jade represents or what she's meant to represent. And I think Michel Ancel, the designer of the game, has been very clever and very cagey about not letting anyone pin that down. I think it seems clear that Ubisoft's big attempt here with her was to situate her in a way that would enable players to identify with her in any way they choose. So it's very easy to find posts on the internet about Jade as a black woman, Jade as a Latina woman, Jade as an Asian woman. The player sees what he or she wants to see, and I think she lends herself to that kind of treatment. But the game, I think, also prioritizes interactions with other species of animals and other creatures, kind of sort of anthropomorphic versions of animals that clearly represent all walks of life, all ethnicities. There's a certain effort to give characters dialects in the game. I think you might be tempted initially to assume that there's a certain kind of stereotyping going on. There's a little character called Segundo. He's this little miniature kind of digital character who appears. He's got this very pronounced, what sounds to me like Hispanic dialect going on. But over in the boards, some people suggested that they're hearing kind of other things in that. But however you look at it, your first impression might be that he's this kind of arch stereotype character. But when you place him in the world and the kind of whole menagerie of people and places and species, and some are creatures, some are human-esque, some are animals. It's this crazy collection. But I think the game goes a long way to presenting this world in which all these people really have figured out how to get along and how to rely on each other to survive under what the game suggests are, very difficult circumstances. Ultimately, I think what Beyond Good and Evil suggests, and in this case, I can easily avoid spoilers because they don't help me make any points, really. I think what it ultimately suggests is a message that I think has a particular kind of resonance today, and that is that you really need to be careful about trusting your government and your leaders when it's clear that the media has given over to supporting them at all costs. Lots of discussion over on the boards about whether or not this game has any kind of connection to Iraq and embedded reporters. And of course, Jade's a journalist, and the whole question of the media and journalism is a big factor in Beyond Good and Evil. Everywhere you go, you hear the voice of the leader of these obviously kind of nefarious government organization. They basically own the media. The media is their handmaiden. And so part of what the game's exploring is, from Jade's point of view as a journalist, how do you penetrate that? But beyond that, how do you defeat it? And this, to me, is where the game really just kind of elevates beyond most other games in terms of the values that it embraces. Because in the end, what she must do is tell the truth. That's it. She must get visual evidence of the truth. And there's this kind of certainty that the game has that if we present the truth to people and we produce it in a way that's unvarnished and that just lay it out there for them, that they will see what their government's doing and they will make the right choices. And so Jade's ultimate sort of gift is an ability to sort of summon the courage necessary to go behind the scenes and expose these things, not by defeating some waves of monsters or enemies, or not by, facing boss battle after boss battle. Ultimately, she just has to get pictures and she has to send them back, and they have to prove the truth. When you add that up with the relationships that the game depicts among characters and the kind of loving peacefulness of the early stages of the game, this kind of vision of a somewhat utopian kind of life, a meditative kind of approach to living. We see Jade at the beginning of the game meditating with a little child next to her as she's teaching him how to do that. It's just a whole different kind of video game world to me that I love visiting. And despite what we might point at as kind of conventional flaws in the game or maybe limitations in terms of the way the game develops, the gameplay stuff like combat or NPC characters that don't necessarily have any real value, ultimately underneath it all is a kind of an embrace, a philosophical embrace of virtues that I would argue you can find in video games, but very rarely do you find them explored in any meaningful way. And very rarely do you find the player able to kind of sort of engage in those virtues through the behavior of the character in the game. Ultimately, when you get right down to it, what Jade's really trying to do, very simply, she's just trying to pay the bills so that she can take care of these orphans that live in this converted lighthouse. And these missions that she takes on, you know, are ultimately a way for her to be able to pay the bills and do what she really cares about, which is take care of these orphans. And her pursuit of the truth, those orphans essentially are what's at stake for her in these missions that she takes on. And to me, that just adds a lot more resonance to the whole overarching quest that she takes on at the beginning of the game. If you haven't played Beyond Good and Evil, I highly recommend it to you. Yeah, a lot of people love it, and I think maybe because it's become a bit of a cult favorite that there's been a little bit of a backlash to the game as well. You can make up your own mind, but I would highly recommend it to you. And for what it's worth, I would recommend playing it on a console. It just plays better. I think the game was clearly designed for a controller. A lot of people on the boards have complained about the controls on the PC port. So I would recommend getting hold of the console version of the game if you can. And if you do, I really think you'll enjoy it. I want to talk a little bit about spoilers now, and I promise not to cover too much territory that I already covered in my post about this over on the blog. But, you know, it was kind of an education for me, this whole conversation about spoilers, because my original intention was to just sort of raise the issue from the point of view of someone who writes about games pretty much every day. And that is, you know, this constant spoiler alert mentality, or this notion that we mustn't reveal spoilers, is a terribly limiting way of going about writing about video games. And that my concern is that we're sort of hamstringing ourselves needlessly by sort of clinging to this notion that we can't discuss video games in any kind of online public way, lest we reveal some spoiler or plot detail that might ruin the game for someone. And I wrote it, I think partly as well in response to a series of kind of situations that I just kind of inadvertently bumped into, where either in a forum or just reading other people writing about games or thinking about writing about a game myself, I just had this notion in my head of, oh, I can't say this, or oh, what if I say that, or whatever. The community that surrounds video games is very much driven inside the online universe. And that's unlike, I would argue, books or movies or theater or anything else, that so many of us, the high percentage of us who play video games are also online. And I think that affects our discourse. We talk in certain ways because we know we're talking very publicly, or we write about games in certain ways because we know we're writing very publicly on the internet. But I strongly contend that you cannot let this spoiler mentality drive your approach to writing about games. And I think that's true with criticism, certainly, particularly criticism of games. But I would also argue even with game reviews. Game reviews clearly differ from critiques, and I understand that. But it does still seem to me that if your approach in a review is to consider something that would reveal a plot point or something that the audience might not know if they haven't played the game, if that point is pertinent to your review, if it's germane to the point that you're making about the game in your review, then you have an obligation to say it, to deal with it, to address it. And the same holds true, even more so, I would argue, in sort of formal criticism of games or game writing that could be seen as formal criticism. Now, having said all of this, one of the things that the conversation taught me was that plenty of people are really passionate about the idea that it's a terrible thing to spoil a game for someone who's playing it for the first time and really treasures that experience of discovery. And I did not mean to suggest in my post that I think we ought to just all go around, you know, taking all the filters off and blah, blah, blah. That was never my intention. And plenty of people said, look, just use common sense. You know, just put spoilers ahead at the beginning of a post that you're going to make about a certain game, and then you've covered yourself and everything's fine. And yeah, that makes sense to me. So I understand that. I think my point is more broadly focused on just the question of how we write about games, how we talk about games, and it's just an overall concern that we let our fear of spoilers drive us in a certain direction that I think is fairly counterproductive. So I'm sure we can all meet each other halfway and, you know, send the alerts out when we need to, and we'll be fine. What really emerged out of the post for me, though, was something more interesting than just the question of what do we do about spoilers. And it's sort of two conversations that emerged out of it. And both of these conversations indicate to me that we really do see things very differently as gamers, developers, people who are passionate about games, enthusiasts, whatever you want to call us, designers, critics. That among us, there's pretty significant kind of divided opinion about certain things. And I think it's useful to sort of throw it out there and take a look at how all this plays out. So the first issue is review versus critique, or the difference between a reviewer and a critic. This was a major topic that emerged out of that spoilers post. I think the lion's share of comments posted had to do with this question. And I'm going to take the minority opinion on this one. I'm going to suggest pretty strongly that I don't think reviewers are terribly different from critics, and I'll explain what I mean by that. But more importantly, I see the reviewer's function as significantly more ambitious than the guy or the woman who helps people decide whether or not they should buy certain games. In other words, if the reviewer's function is basically to work as a consumer reporter to help people make educated buying decisions, that to me is a seriously flawed perception and a terribly limiting perception of what a reviewer should be up to. And here's why. I'm aware of the fact that people read reviews to help decide whether or not to buy certain games or see certain movies or whatever. So I'm aware that there is a certain kind of information exchange that occurs, right? I play a game, I write a review of it, you read it, and you can make a decision. The problem with that approach, I think, well, I have several problems with it. One is that it essentially, you know, kind of commodifies a game into what is essentially a purchase decision, right? So my sort of whole philosophical approach to this piece of writing that I'm going to do about the game is all informed by the idea that you need to know whether or not to buy it. That's the wrong foot to step off on, in my opinion, if you're going to write intelligently about games. And I'm not suggesting that there can't be people out there who are writing purely thumbs up, thumbs down, or buy it, don't buy it reviews. That's fine. Go do that. But my idea of a reviewer is significantly more ambitious than that. And it seems to me that what a reviewer is trying to do is look at a game shortly after it comes out, during that time frame when there's a kind of a building critical reception to something, and that person is a voice among other voices in sort of ringing in on how that game should be seen, what value it has, how is it effective, is it successful, does it make good on its promises, is it worth buying? Yeah, that could be one criteria for judgment of the game. But by itself, if we look at a game and limit our focus to the question of whether that game, you know, gets over this threshold of buy, don't buy, if that's the only way we have of looking at it, then we're really shooting ourselves in the foot. Reviewers have the ability to respond to games on all sorts of levels. And that interaction with the game that the reviewer has is, I would say, different from the critics only insofar as you're typically working with less space. It's a shorter form of writing. Your response is more immediate rather than maybe considered over time. It's typically less comparative, less perhaps contextually, you know, connected to things like genre and other broader things. It would have less to do with how a game evolves in our imagination and sort of the reception that it's received over time. The kinds of things that critics are interested in that I'm describing, those things might be less a part of a reviewer's response to a game. But to suggest that a reviewer must kind of gut out the critical eye that he or she brings to the process simply because he or she's the first one on the scene responding to a game, that I can't tell you anything specific about the game because it might spoil it, I can't describe any details of the plot or whatever because it might spoil it, that's just absurd to me. And what's worse, I think it sort of cedes the real heavy-duty writing to the critics, who we know will be more responsible and do a better job of this later down the road, you know? That just doesn't make any sense to me. A critic can function as a reviewer, and a reviewer can function as a critic. And I understand that they're two different things, that they often function differently, but when you get right down to it, when a reviewer looks at a game and tries to explain to a reader how that game works, why it works, why it doesn't, and all sorts of other considerations you bring to the table, you cannot put limits on that process for that writer purely for the sake of preserving plot details for readers. Now, having said all of this, it clearly seems to me that with reviewers, writing reviews of games that have just come out for an audience of players who haven't yet played those games, we should operate with a certain set of assumptions. One of those assumptions might be players don't want spoilers in reviews. Fair enough. I think giving a warning, suggesting that a spoiler is to come, or just at the beginning of the whole thing, suggesting that this piece will have spoilers, that's fair. And then we're all on the same page, it seems to me. But to suggest that reviewers, by definition, should not reveal too much about a game because they're reviewers, I can't accept that idea. I think that's an absurd idea. And I think it's, again, needlessly limiting the reviewer to a consumer reporter. And I don't want to be that kind of reviewer. And I don't know why you would want to be that kind of reviewer, to be completely frank. Now, the other question that emerged was probably significantly more interesting than the reviewer versus critic question. And it has to do with how we see games as narrative, and what is narrative about narrative, and where does narrative come from, and what part of a game, your interaction, your engagement with that game, your experience of playing it, where in that process does the narrative emerge? This perspective, of course, was sort of thrown on the table in the spoiler post by Clint Hocking, who came by and sort of reframed the whole thing. And he did so in a way that I think provoked people to examine, well, I should say provoked me to examine how I think narrative works. And having examined it, I think he's wrong. but I also understand where he's coming from, and I think I understand what he's shooting for, and I think all that's really cool, and I agree with it. So I'm being very vague. Let me try to be more specific. What Hocking did was he came by basically in this whole spoiler post and said, look, here's the pertinent question. It plot stuff, like what happens to Elik at the end of Prince of Persia, what happens in Call of Duty 4 and a certain moment of the story, what happens in other, this is all just what he calls imposed narrative. It's just stuff that's in games that, you know, sort of, it's an element of the whole thing, but not the key element, not the driving element, not the pivotal thing that makes a player's experience unique. So in his view, there are no spoilers. You can say all that stuff anytime you want, because that's not really what's core to the experience of playing a good video game. So for him, the mechanics, the dynamics of the story, the dynamics of the game are what create the experience that a player has, and that could have a narrative dimension, but that is significantly more important than whatever sort of sprinkled in plot points and character reveals the games include. Now, I'm suggesting that point of view is diametrically opposed to the perceptions that many of us bring to playing video games. And and that we ought to look at this kind of collision and try to figure out what to do with it and how best to respond to it. Because as I read it, what Hawking is saying to me, and I'm thinking about the previous segment where I talk about Jade and, you know, all of the nurturing and all of the love and all of the good plot stuff and character stuff in Beyond Good and Evil. I treasure that. It means something to me. It communicates important things to me. What I'm hearing Hawking say is, you know, that stuff really actually isn't very important. I think it is, but I understand from his point of view why games aren't living up to their full potential, aren't, you know, sort of embracing what they can and should be as interactive, experiential kinds of processes, sort of all in a complex way occurring for a player. I understand that that's something he wants to point us at and say that's where we need to go. For me, I think we have to keep talking to each other, because I'm not convinced that mechanic-driven, experience-driven, exploring-driven, sort of emergent narrative experience, I think the jury's still out on whether that works. And I suppose one response to that would be, from his perspective, and I'm totally putting words in his mouth that's completely inappropriate here, so please, apologies for saying anything that isn't correct. But my guess is that the response to that would be, well, we're just not there yet. That we're taking steps, and that as we continue to move towards game experiences where narrative emerges from the player's experience creating it, that when we get better at that, that people like me will be more satisfied by that. And I'm willing to trust that that's going to happen, I suppose, to some degree, but I'm also not quite willing to surrender the idea that cutscenes can actually be effective sometimes. That narrative, as it's revealed through interactions with NPCs and with other kind of non-dynamic forces in a game, that those things can carry value, can carry meaning, can provoke players in interesting ways, and that we really aren't quite, I think, at a place where we can fully agree that one system or one way of thinking about games is necessarily superior to the other. But what does seem clear to me is that people that I have a tremendous amount of respect and admiration for, Hawking certainly one, we've mentioned Steve Gaynor many times, and many other people who've been very public as designers about talking about where we need to go, I want them to keep going there. I want them to keep doing what they're doing and sort of pushing us to reconsider how we think about the way games are built. But I also don't want them to stop listening to those of us, I think, who bring a certain way of thinking about story and characters and our engagement in terms of empathetic relationships with author-created characters. That those things still have value, and that there are ways that those can continue to have meaning in other sorts of interactive media experiences that I think these game designers are shooting for. So I fear that I've been very long-winded and very convoluted here, and apologies for that, but I'm sorting through different ways of thinking about essentially the bottom line that we're all about here. The reason we create blogs, the reason that we go to these forums and have these arguments and, you know, fist-pounding sort of on the table issue driven moments. It's what should we be doing with these video games that we love so much, and how can we make them better? And my little spoiler post suggested to me accidentally, really with no intention of bringing the issue up, that we really remain in opposite camps in certain ways, but maybe that's not the case. Maybe it's not opposite camps. Maybe it's just different perspectives being brought to bear on this infant medium that we all care so much about and we all want to realize its full potential. I'm sure that we'll continue to talk about these things and think about these things for some time to come. Well, that's it for the podcast, everybody. I want to thank you for joining me. I'll be back soon with another edition, including another gathering of the Gamers Confab. So until then, happy gaming. See you next time.